It's a pleasure to have Dr. Tilman Pfau with us. Tilman is at University of Stuttgart as a professor. He has done his studies at University of Konstanz in the group of Jürgen Milnik, and he has worked on atom interferometry, and right now he's interested in Bose-Einstein condensation and applications in quantum information. So,
thank you for the invitation and the possibility to talk about our work here a little bit. Now, we were discussing yesterday what I should really present, and in view of the Nobel Prize, I slightly shifted my plans and we'll talk about a few things that we were doing in Konstanz still in the field of atom optics, and then also report on a few things that I was involved in Wolfgang Ketteler's group. I was a guest scientist there in 99. And then at the end, I will sort of speculate a little bit on the future. That's this part here, where we will be talking about possibilities in the field of quantum information. But very briefly, and I would like to keep this as an open discussion, and you should any time interrupt me. Now, let's start with the basic interactions, basic physics behind all of that, which is very, very simple. Namely that you ask yourself how light interacts with matter, and later on how matter interacts with light. Light interacting with matter is just depicted in this little cartoon here. Is some on the easiest level described with the Lorentz model, where you describe matter as little dipoles that can be excited by light, and that of course changes the propagation, and it leads to the dispersive shape in the refractive index, for example, every time you're hitting a resonance of these dipoles in the material. And that is very familiar to you, and it's already the basis of what we will use as an interaction between matter and light as well. Because if you think of an atom representing the matter part here, again as a dipole, and you put it into some electric field, say first of all in a static electric field, and this induces a dipole, and this dipole is just aligned with the electric field, and its proportionality constant is the polarizability. Now this dipole interacts with the electric field via this d dot e term, and leads to a potential energy that this atom now will feel that is proportional to E squared and has a negative sign, meaning that the atoms get attracted towards high intensity regions or high electric field regions. Okay, where the E squared is large, the potential is most negative and the atoms get attracted to there. That's straightforward and simple, and can be extended to the atoms that have a dipole transition. Now there, it's not a static electric field, but a laser field that you shine in that is oscillating at optical frequencies. And in that case, as in any resonant case, you have to distinguish two cases, namely the case where the driving frequency is below resonance or the driving frequency is above resonance. And the only difference that is of interest in our context right now there is that the dipole not only gets, of course, resonantly enhanced, and therefore the interaction strength goes up very high, but also that there is a phase shift between the orientation of the dipole above resonance, which is 180 degrees, and below resonant frequency, which is more like the DC case, namely that the two vectors point in the same direction. So the picture that you get from that little consideration with one dipole transition in the atom at this resonant frequency is that the polarizability now gets resonantly enhanced and changes sign around the resonance frequency of this little dipoles that you find in the atoms. And that's about all you need to understand about the interaction of atoms with light fields for the rest of this talk. Now, you can see the direct analogy, of course, to the dispersion theory for light propagating through matter. Here you can go vice versa and say the matter, namely the atoms, travel through light fields, say inhomogeneous light fields, and experience either a refractive index for the matter waves now that is larger than one or smaller than one, depending on the detuning of your laser field that the atom is traveling through. Okay? So that's the basic physics for the interaction that we are going to deal with now in various situations. And I'm trying to describe to you the interaction of atoms mainly only in standing light fields there that have some periodic pattern, basically. And the first thing that I would like to describe there is our effort on atom lithography. That is an experiment using chromium atoms. So that's a standard lithography material that you can manipulate exactly the way I described. Namely, if you take this beam and point it, in that case downwards, through a standing light field that you just get by retroreflecting a laser beam from one mirror, say, then the interaction with this inhomogeneous light field leads to a focusing of the trajectories of the atoms. So around the minimum here is a harmonic potential in first approximation, and this harmonic potential is a lens potential for these atoms. So you can think of this standing light field as an array of cylindrical lenses for the motion of those atoms, and you see if you do a little calculation that all of these trajectories come to a plane where which you can consider to be a focal plane of this lens array. Now, if you put a substrate exactly at that position, you can evaporate the chromium atoms onto the substrate. You do it for 5 to 10 minutes and take the substrate out. And that's the way it looks. It has a regular structure of lines corresponding to the focal points of those cylindrical lenses that are spaced by lambda over 2, which is just the period of the standing light field. And okay, these structures are characterized with atomic force microscopes. And in the case of chromium, this resonant dipole transition is at 425 nanometers, so the spacing between those lines is 213 or so nanometers. Okay, this is a first example of the interaction of atoms with these inhomogeneous or standing light fields. But it is, as I depicted here, really geometrical optics that we are doing. There is no coherence whatsoever involved here. This is a thermal beam of atoms that is just traveling through the light mask. And the way we are dealing, treating this problem as you know, trajectories is really the geometrical optics way to do that. Okay. Now, in view of the Nobel Prize, some people, if you read carefully in this text or this manuscript that they have on the web, that is that atom lasers in the future might be used for doing exactly this. Now, there's a little word of caution from my side, at least, because this is really done with an MBE oven at 1500 degrees C that spits out quite a lot of flux, whereas a BEC contains typically a few million atoms, and you can prepare them every 10 seconds or something. So the flux of that is orders of magnitude lower than the flux required to write a structure like that. And it is also not fully clear whether you will actually gain from the coherence properties of that condensate, at least if you want to produce structures that way. But if there's somebody interested in this, we can certainly discuss more about this. Okay, so really what this is very classical, as you see here. It is filling atom by atom through some funnels, basically, into some grooves, okay? Now, let's work a little bit more. What can you do with it? We have been writing lines by reflecting a laser beam from one mirror, but of course you can make more complex interference patterns. This one is done by reflecting the laser beam twice from two mirrors and producing a hexagonal interference pattern. Now, if you send the atoms through this light mask, again, it's an array, this time not of cylindrical lenses, but of hexagonally ordered micro lenses, if you want, for the atoms. And if you now go to the focal plane, in the reticuled case, then the atoms get focused onto spots, that these are the focal spots, and you can see them in your force microscopy picture there. Actually, there is a large area that is covered with very highly regularly spaced dots on this hexagonal lattice. Now, you can make use of the property of the atom-light interaction, namely its frequency dependence, to change its pattern. If you just detune your laser, you know, by acoustic optic modulator, say a few hundred megahertz to the blue side of the resonance, then with exactly the same setup you are writing this structure, because you just change the sign in the interaction potential and invert the structure. So one little parameter which is can be changed very fast in the experiment, inverts the structure, and you're writing honeycomb patterns on your substrate. That's sort of one feature that this technique has, that with the light parameters you can change the structure that you are actually writing. And without going into detail, I just show you a few of those structures that we have been writing. You, of course, you can write cubic structures. These are cubic dots that are regularly spaced on a large scale. You can produce super lattices, you know, that if your interference pattern is more complex, you basically can copy all possible interference patterns into chromium patterns on some surface here. But of course, if you have a lithography background, then you will immediately argue, okay, what is the advantage at all? Because the period will always be limited by lambda over 2 again, like is the resolution of any optical lithography technique. There are ways around that, and we demonstrated them. If you consider the atom-light interaction a little bit more carefully, if you take into account that the atoms have a magnetic substructure, this is depicted here as an example, as if for an atom that has a one-half ground, I mean, J equals one-half ground state, that finds itself not in an intensity gradient field, but in a polarization gradient field. Then through the coupling of these Zeeman levels with the various polarization components of the light field, you can get interlaced gratings. In this case, it's an interlaced grating for the minus one-half state, that is this line here, which has a period of lambda over 2, and a just inverted structure for the positive Zeeman substate. So if you work with atoms that are initially unpolarized, then you will write a lambda over 4 period. Okay, so that's a factor of 2 compared to the optical lithography. Actually, our chromium atoms are more complicated, and they are higher. The more magnetic sublevels you have, the higher Fourier components you can generate. And that way, we have demonstrated lambda over 8 periods. There's one structure as an example here, which in our case is about 60 nanometer period in this line structure. Now, this becomes interesting now to compete, say, with other existing lithography techniques. However, of course, other techniques are very mature and well developed. And our technique is still, of course, in basic research. And the question is, what can we offer as maybe possible applications that maybe other techniques cannot easily accomplish? And I want to show you one example for that, namely, again, due to the physics of the atom-light interaction, we can do the following. This light mask, you know, that is basically a phase mask for the atoms as they move through, is very selective. Due to the resonant character of this dipole interaction, or this dipole transition in the atoms, only actually one isotope, say, of this chromium beam is getting focused. Everything else just penetrates through that without being really affected. So what you can think of, and that's what I'm going to describe, is to take some other material of your choice, grow it as a homogeneous background, and then take the other atoms of your choice, hit a resonant dipole transition with a light mask, and focus them into your homogeneously grown matrix material. So that way you can produce a sample that has a structure in the doping concentration. Okay, and in our experiment, as we are working with those chromium atoms, we just took them and mixed them with what is easy to evaporate, namely magnesium fluoride. So we have two ovens producing the two things at the same time, and we were trying to produce bulk material that has a structured doping. And applications for that could be photonic crystals, as you understand that the structures that we are writing are intrinsically long-range periodic, and you don't have to rely on some e-beam, you know, drift correction and so on to produce highly reliable long-period periodic structures. Okay, so
Can you imagine doping phosphorus in a regular array on silicon?
Of course, this is an interesting question. Phosphorus, I mean, you're talking about phosphorus ions, of course.
Yes.
And then, of course, also single ions.
It doesn't have, I mean, actually, you want the phosphorus atom,
yes,
which will then give away its ion.
Okay, so one has to look into the level scheme of phosphorus, which is not completely easy. I mean, mm-hmm, chromium, we choose chromium because it is reasonably well controllable with laser cooling techniques. In phosphorus, it's more difficult. I mean, you have a fine structure in the ground state, and it's just the technical effort due to this electronic structure is much more involved than with the chromium. But in principle, I would say, if you have, you know, unlimited funding, that should still be possible.
But the other isotopes are still deposited.
Sorry?
If you have other isotopes, then they are still in
the... Yes. Well, then one would have to look at the isotope shifts and so on, whether... but if you have a laser system that is able to manipulate the phosphorus in the first place, then, of course, you can first deflect the right isotope to the side and then only work with them.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is just to convince you that what I advertised is really working. Namely, we have this sample here that has a bulk material of these two components. And in what we do in order to probe that what we did is really what I said, is that we take an electron beam here from a scanning electron microscope, and we analyze the Auger electrons here. Now, this is very surface sensitive. It has a penetration depth of 1 to 2 nanometers only. And if you take the spectrum of those electrons, you get the information of what is contained in that surface layer of that sample. Okay? And then later on, we are going to etch down into that, into the bulk material, and check layer by layer, basically, what is contained in this material. And here are the typical traces. You see, at the surface, we have etched 4 nanometers away from the surface at that point already. We have magnesium, we have fluor, that's the magnesium fluoride, and we have a little chromium peak that becomes more dominant if we, you know, our samples from the top are usually a little bit contaminated because we don't work in very nice environments. It's just a 10 to the minus 7 millibar atomic beam apparatus, so it's by no means clean in your, or in the sense that somebody is doing, that is doing surface physics. But after you etch about 10 nanometers from the top, you see clearly magnesium fluoride and the chromium signal in the spectrum of these Auger electrons. And you can follow this all the way down to the bottom, which is 50 nanometers. That just depends on how long you actually evaporate here. And then at 50 nanometers, you see the silicon substrate showing up. So you, by etching down, you have reached the substrate at the bottom here. Okay, and now what you do in order to check for the spatial structure of the dopant is that you take your spectrometer on one of those chromium peaks and start to scan the electron beam here. And then you see that you have a periodic structure. This is done at 20 nanometers on this peak here has been scanned. And if you do the same thing on the magnesium, you don't see anything, right? Okay. So this is just to illustrate that this technique, working already with thermal atoms, might have some applications that are not easily done by conventional techniques. Just think of somebody wants a photonic crystal material that has this spiral doping, okay? Maybe you are interested in the handedness of some material, okay? Then in our case, we just have to move the substrate, rotate it as we are growing it, and that's a one-step process. If you wanted to do such a structure with conventional lithography techniques, you would have to divide the spiral into stairs and produce stair by stair in discrete steps. So it's many, many processes that you have to go through here. And that's just an example of what this technique could offer as possible applications that other techniques at least have difficulty to accomplish. The resolution, as I said, of these individual lines, the width of these individual lines, can be as low as 30 nanometer in our experiments. Other people have even reached 20 nanometer or something like this. Okay, this was the first part here. As I said, it's geometrical optics, and we applied it for lithography purposes. Now, next point that I want to draw your attention on is the interaction of atoms with those standing light fields close to a surface. And that will lead to the field where we are using really cold atoms now. In the first part, we are not using condensates at all. We are just using laser-cooled atoms, but very far away from the condensation point. Still, as they are cold, you can manipulate them on the surface and build, say, an integrated circuit for the atoms that propagate on that surface. And that's what I want to show to you. So the idea would be that, in analogy to integrated optics that you do with light, you sort of integrate in one device, first of all, a source of atoms. In our case, it will be a continuously operating source, which is actually a specialty of this experiment, and that cannot be easily done with the alkali atoms that are now discussed a lot. Then you want to have a waveguide, something that guides the atoms along the surface, that they can be split and recombined, and you know. And then you want to have a detector also integrated in that circuit at some place here, so that the whole thing can operate continuously, so that you don't have to do any switching stuff and preparation. You really want to have this operating as a continuous circuit, and that's what I'm going to show you. Everything that I will be talking about here is happening at a distance from that prism surface here that is comparable to 1 micrometer or below, so very, very close to the surface. And that's also something that is special to this experiment. Other experiments on atom chips that you might have heard about usually happen at distances of at least 10 micrometers or even farther away. Now, how do we get that close to the surface? Well, again, we don't use magnetic guiding as other people, Jörg Schmidmeier's group and other people do. We use, again, a standing light field. this is our vacuum system. We have a prism here. And we just take a laser beam and reflect it from this gold-coated prism. And that way, you build up a standing wave. And now, if you manage to populate only, say, the node or antinode of the standing wave above that surface, that is as close as the optical wavelength to the surface. Okay, so you just have to find surface-sensitive ways to populate atoms only here and not, you know, everywhere in that standing wave. And I'm going to show you how this works. First of all, we have to bring cold atoms close to the surface. And here's our prism again, and we are operating a magneto-optical trap in a way that is slightly unconventional, but you shouldn't worry about these details. This is the surface here, and you see the first thing that happens if you move cold atoms to the surface is that that they are colliding with the surface, of course, and as the surface is hot and the atoms are cold, the atoms are immediately lost by such a collision. Now you have to protect the atoms from that surface somehow, and you can do that by evanescent light fields.
You see,
this is typically, say, from here to here is maybe a millimeter. Okay. Yeah. So if you want to protect the atoms from hitting the surface, you can use the blue detuned light field that, you know, is a repulsive potential if you use an evanescent field. And the evanescent field in our case is just produced by shining in a laser from the backside. Now, I told you that we have a gold-coated prism, and what we really do is that we excite surface plasmons in that gold coating, which even enhances the evanescent field on the vacuum side here.
Okay.
53 nanometers. So there is a certain condition on the thickness in order to have the phase matching condition for the plasmon excitation, but that's easy to do, and we actually win by that and get a stronger evanescent field than we would get from a bare prism that is uncoated. So if you do that and sort of measure the lifetime of the atoms at the surface, when the situation is really such that the atoms are in touch with the surface, you see that if you increase the reflection laser beam power, that's the power of that laser, the lifetime grows again. And up to values that are limited by our vacuum system here, which is 300 milliseconds, but it could be much, much longer. That's really just due to our bad vacuum system. So you see that we can produce a reservoir of atoms, of cold atoms, in touch with the surface, and in touch up to a wavelength or even a fraction of the wavelength with the surface. Okay. Now, next thing is that we take this reservoir of cold atoms and we want to transfer them now into our wave structure of the standing wave above the surface. And that's where the special atom comes in that we are actually using. That's argon, okay, in the metastable state of argon. Why are we using that? Because it provides a level scheme that is sort of a little bit more complicated than what you find in alkali atoms. They are, like in helium, maybe that's more familiar to some of you, there are two metastable states. In helium, you would say it's a singlet and the triplet metastable state. These are these two states here. And we start out in this triplet state, say. It's a 1s5 state in the other convention. And this one provides a closed transition that you can use for laser cooling. And that's where we operate this magneto-optical trap at the surface. Now, as the argon is heavier than helium, the LS coupling is not perfect, and you have a possibility to pump the atoms from the triplet to the singlet branch. Okay, so if you shine a laser here on this transition, then the atoms will, by scattering only one single photon, be pumped over to here. Now, here, first of all, this state has no magnetic moment, so they don't feel any magnetic fields anymore, and they don't see this light anymore because it's not resonant with this state. So from one moment to the other, you switch off the magneto-optical trap fields, I mean the light fields and the magnetic fields, instantaneously. So what we really do is we take the reservoir of slow atoms in this state close to the surface. This is now rotated by 90 degrees, so this is again our prism here. And I plot the respective potentials in front of that surface this way. So the slow atoms come along in that state and come from that reservoir. And I said that we have this reflection laser that repels the atoms from the surface. So usually what happens is they go up here and then go back into the reservoir and then they try to collide with the surface again and get reflected. But if we now use another evanescent field here on this transition, then most probably at the classical turning point, where also the evanescent intensity is largest, these atoms will be pumped into the other state. Okay? Now, the other state immediately doesn't feel this reflection laser anymore, it doesn't feel the MOD laser anymore, but you can trap it with a third laser, and that's the one that we reflect from the front side. So if you take this trap beam reflected here, we get a standing wave, and if we match up the conditions right, you know, that's just a overlap integral that you have to optimize here, then you can get a high transfer efficiency of atoms that are pumped here into a trapped state close to the surface. That's sort of the surface sensitive loading mechanism that we are using, and it's based on optical pumping. Is this clear? This is difficult, but okay. Now our situation is the following. We have this reservoir of cold atoms. We have this waveguide potential for the other state of these atoms, and we are transferring them here from one state to the other. And what happens is that if you take this standing wave beam and you take a cylindrically focused one, and so looking from top, it looks like a linear waveguide, yes, then the atoms are pumped into this waveguide here, and they will, of course, just move out and will be guided along this standing light field and transversely confined in the redly tuned case just by the Gaussian envelope of that laser beam. Okay, so that way we can produce a linear guide. So that's we are building an atomic beam experiment on a small scale here slowly. So we have a continuous source here that produces a continuous flux of atoms in this waveguide. Now to make this visible, what we did is just put a wire into the laser beam such that there is no light intensity here, and that is then a shutter, yes? I mean, the potential, that intensity stops, and that is in the redly tuned case, a maximum in the potential. So the atoms can make their way up to here, but then they are blocked. And this shows you already that with light fields, of course, you can do many, many things that are maybe from the outside of the vacuum that are not simply done with magnetic fields, okay? So if you move the shutter position, you see that the atoms move up to here, up to here, up to here on your surface. Okay, so this is the waveguide just by a cylindrical focus of the laser beams. And in order, I mean, this is operating continuously, but in order to show that something is going on, it's better to say at some point open this shutter and show you that atoms are flowing out. So you want, maybe you if you are used to atomic beam experiments, you would call it a time of flight experiment, right? At some point you open your source and atoms flow out and travel along this waveguide to the side here. And that's how it looks like. At the time equals zero, you have the shutter position here, so atoms accumulate up to here, and then you take off that shadow here. You know, this is just a mechanical piece in the way of your laser beam outside the vacuum somewhere, and you just take it out with a relay, and then the atoms start to spread over the whole distance. So this is just to show you that really there is a guiding going on. And the final part is the detector. So you want to have a detector that is also continuously operating. And again, we are using this dipole interaction that I introduced at the very first slide. And we are using evanescent fields again, which are surface sensitive, but this time not to repel the atoms, but to attract the atoms to the surface. Okay, so if you take at this position a evanescent field that actually lowers the potential such that the atoms that are close to the surface get sucked to the surface, then we can detect the atoms here. Now here I should say actually how we detect the atoms. These are metastable argon atoms, and when they hit a gold surface, a secondary electron is released. So we have a little electron optics and an MCP plate that is detecting these electrons, and these are the pictures that I'm showing here. That is detecting these electrons with a high spatial and, of course, even higher than required temporal resolution. So if we have a waveguide operating and the atoms are kept away from the surface, we don't see any signal, okay, because they are just traveling there and we don't see any electrons. If, however, we switch on that beam here at some point within the waveguide, then we suck the atoms locally to the surface and we can detect them there. Actually, that way we also make sure that what we are doing is really happening close to the surface, because this evanescent field here also reaches only out to less than 1 micrometer from the surface. So if there would be atoms in a higher lying minima, we would never affect them and would not attract them to the surface, because this is the situation. Only this, actually, the closest one, we cannot use, because there's the van der Waals interaction that makes this already bending down, and we don't trap atoms here. We really trap atoms in the second antinode of the standing wave above the surface, which is 800 nanometers away. Okay, and this one, by the evanescent field that is, you know, if you switch on the detector, this is the effective potential that you expect. This one is still caught, and this one is not affected at all from the evanescent field. Okay, so this is just to...
Now, you know, you said it sounded as though you were destructive to the argon. Okay.
It is a destructive detection.
It would be interesting to have a variety of atoms. Do you see any prospect for that?
Of course, what I show you here from the experimental point of view heavily depends on the properties of argon, namely how we detect it, what is the level scheme, and so on. So for every specific element that you would be interested in, one would have to look into the level scheme, whether or not these kind of things are possible or not. So many, many things are directly related to the electronic structure. So what I showed you here, for example, with this surface-sensitive loading here, some people discuss and propose things now for alkali atoms, but it is certainly not as straightforward as in argon. Okay. Now, you know that in helium there's also a condensate being produced by the Alain Aspect's group and also by Cohen Tanucci's group in Paris. The reason why they can produce a condensate is that the LS coupling is almost perfect in helium, and therefore this Penning collisions can be suppressed in the purely spin polarized case. That means at the same time that this intercombination line that we are using here for pumping is strongly forbidden. So it seems okay that it is hard for them to do something that we are doing here. But say with other atoms, and it really depends on the atom that we can discuss various atoms, but there's no general rule, that's maybe the message. to say this is the technique that you would use for everybody. Okay.
Second question. I mean, you showed the waveguide, but
yes.
It would be interesting for instance to build an arm,
of course, there are many things.
Can you imagine how to do that?
Well, for with the light fields, it's very, very simple. You can get any circuit that you like by just putting a slide in the way of your laser beam that contains an imprint of that circuit. Okay. Then you basically image that slide from outside the vacuum chamber onto your prism, and then the atoms will move along. That's the easy answer. The fair answer is that anything that we are doing here is still, you know, multi-mode. It is by no means single mode in the transverse direction, because
my next question.
Okay.
Then you have a problem.
Again, I mean, here the transverse dimensions are, say, 100 micrometers or a little bit below that. And for the thermal atoms we are using here, many, many transverse modes are occupied. And so it's really like a garden hose. You should really compare it not to a single mode waveguide. That's actually true for all experiments in this field of atom chips, no matter whether they are magnetic or whether they are of that kind.
Yeah, that's a problem, right?
And of course, many people try to combine these techniques now with, well, a perfectly coherent sources, namely Bose-Einstein condensates, and try to occupy single modes in those waveguides. Now with light fields, I think you have a good chance because in principle, again, you can have transverse resolution in the order of the optical wavelengths, which is, say, 1 micrometer, which is also possible probably in these magnetic structures. There you have to write current-carrying wires on the surface with that resolution by optical lithography, for example. Here you use the optical patterning directly. You don't have a lithography step, and that is, in my view, it's an advantage because you can, for example, modulate those light fields very fast. And you can change them as a function of time. Whereas if you have written a magnetic structure somewhere, you can change the overall current but not the shape of these wires anymore, right? So it depends, I would say, the techniques.
But you can make any shape you want, which you can do with the light.
Why not? I mean, I can make any shape that I like. If I take if I take a slide and it has sort of a black everywhere except where you want to guide the atoms along, then you can make any circuit that you like, and you just have to use a slide projector basically to image it onto the surface.
Yeah. Yeah. John Foreman told me that all these chip experiments have to operate at 10 to 20 microns above the surface because of heating. Is that a concern?
I would say it's more technical reasons for them at the moment that they cannot come closer. But heating is, of course, also an issue. You have to remember that this is room temperature here, and this is maybe a few microkelvin. So the question is, how long can you keep this temperature difference at this distance? And of course, the farther you go away, the weaker is the coupling. But there are calculations that say that at this distances and the order of one optical wavelength, the lifetime is several seconds. We have measured our lifetime, but that was just limited by the background gas in our sample, not by the coupling to the surface, to a few hundred milliseconds.
Why can't you cool down the surface?
That wouldn't make a big difference, really, you know. I mean, whether you have this at 300 or 77 or maybe even at 4 Kelvin doesn't make a big difference. It's maybe 2 orders of magnitude out of the 8 orders of magnitude that you have as a difference in temperature. But it doesn't really, it's not the black body radiation, for example, in this prism that hurts you. It's more that when these dipoles here, you know, if you trap them, you have little dipoles, that they have their mirror image in this dielectric here or in the metal, depending on what you take. And these mirror dipoles basically couple to all the thermal excitations in your material. Okay. And of course you win a little bit by cooling this, but it's not a tremendous win. I mean, you win exponentially by going away from the surface, and that's much better, maybe. But if you go away from the surface, then of course you are limited again in the size and the structure, the sizes of structures that you can afford on the surface. If you are 10 micron or more away from the surface, also your lateral period is restricted to that dimension. And turns out that, that for later on, if you think of that being, say, a basis to build a periodic lattice on the surface, where you put single atoms and consider them as qubits, maybe, okay, that the tunneling times that you really want to have for the coupling of those neighboring sites are favorable if you have a spacing in the 1 micrometer regime. Now, this again is exponentially dependent on the period, and if you go to 10 micrometers, already the tunneling times are so long that anything that you want to use there for, you know, any manipulation of these neighboring qubits will take an awful lot of time. So there is a trade-off in terms of how close you go, what rates of tunneling you want to achieve for neighboring sites, and so on.
Yeah, let us see, why does it go exponentially away from the surface, the difference of temperature?
That has to do with the spectrum, the Fourier spectrum of the response here. The farther you are away, the less sensitive you are to Fourier components of the fluctuation in that surface. Okay, so you can. And that's the same reason why you cannot have more lateral period if you are away a certain distance from that surface, because you always couple to the Fourier components of currents, either currents that you create by your wires on purpose, or fluctuating currents that are basically present in this prism. Okay. Okay. Then, of course, a simple thing just. That's very simple, and we did some experiment here to take this beam and retroreflect it, going one step in that direction to, you know, along this surface here, have regularly spaced lattice sites that maybe at some point you can even address. But this is a very preliminary, and not. I don't want to spend too much time on this measurement. It's just an example. You can do a lot of things with light fields, and it can be the lateral scale can be on the lambda over 2 scale. All right. Okay, let's see. Oh, man. I have not even talked about BECs yet. Okay, next point is we are now doing something coherent, okay, with the metro. So we go to back diffraction, and you know, of course, the BECs. That is a cloud of atoms that you see here as a phase contrast image that has a size, a length maybe of even up to 100 micrometers. In that case, this is data from Wolfgang Ketteler's group that I'm showing. You trap it in some trap, and the most striking feature is maybe if you split this condensate into two parts and you let it let loose of the trap, you let it evolve a little, you see this interference pattern. So that just tells you that this is really one effective, say, single particle wave function that is occupied by many, many atoms, and you can do optics with this coherent wave packet now. And let's do some optics with that. Let's do Bragg diffraction for. Again, it's a standing light field and matter interacting with standing light field. This time, the matter wave is really a coherent matter wave, not a geometrical one as before. And you can do Bragg diffraction like you do diffraction of light from matter again. Okay, when this is a thick grating, then you get Bragg diffraction. And what happens really is that as you do this diffraction process, your momentum state gets changed as it takes two photon momenta out of this light wave. As the period is lambda over 2, the momentum, the Fourier components appear at 2k of the, where k is the wave vector of the light, and the imparted in momentum transfer is 2 h bar k. Okay, that's the initial and final momentum. It's very simple. Where does this momentum transfer come from, actually? It comes from a redistribution of photons in this light beams. So you take one photon out of here, it is sort of virtually absorbed, and you emit a stimulated emission, there's a stimulated emission of this excitation into the backgoing beam. Okay, that's an interesting process because, okay, let's see what it means for a condensate. For a condensate, well, the condensate sits at rest, and if you go back to here, you see that your initial, in order to meet a Bragg condition, usually your beam has to have some angle to the Bragg angle to the sample. As the condensate is sitting still, you can either think of moving the condensate with respect to the standing wave, but you can also move the standing wave, of course, by just having two different frequencies here. So that way, you can meet the Bragg condition. And again, there's a momentum transfer of 2HK. Now, if you draw the dispersion relation of the free particle, no interaction whatsoever at the moment, then the initial condensate sits here at 0HK, and the one that you create by interaction with this Bragg grating is the one that is moving this 2HK with respect to the sitting condensate. Okay, so you have an effective two-level system here where the two levels are really motional states. And you are coupling them with these two beams. Okay, this is the experiment. Now this time it's upside down. Laser beams go that way. This is where the condensate sits. Now, you can change the frequency of those laser beams and hit the Bragg resonance and just look how many atoms get coupled out here as a function of that frequency. And you see that there is a nice line shape and a width which is only a few kilohertz wide. So we have a resonance that has a kilohertz line width between those two levels, these two motional levels. So it's a two-level transition, if you like, which has a very narrow line width. Now, coming back, first of all, on the light fields, how can you look at this? You can, again, have these two levels and consider this beam as being a pump and this beam as being a probe beam, and you have a Raman process that is going on, which provides gain for this beam because you're redirecting photons and absorption for the pump beam. And the gain and the absorption feature has a very narrow line width, 2 kilohertz here, okay? And, okay, you can also think of this process as a four-wave mixing process. You have two matter waves, say plane waves, that come in and get out, get coupled, and you have a pump and probe plane wave of the light. And the mixing is this Bragg coupling here, the mixing process, okay? So you can think of this Bragg process also as a four-wave mixing process, and there is gain, and there's a respective two-photon Rabi frequency in the parameters that are associated with
it. Is free particle dispersion appropriate in this?
In the regime that I will be talking about, yes. For the lower lying case, you have to consider the interaction, and there's a Bogle leakage. So we are really in the free particle limit, not in the phonon regime. So that's the next step, that interaction comes into play. But so far, the interaction is between the atoms is not important at all. So we come to this point now where we discuss, first of all, the influence of the condensate on the light again. Okay, you've described there's a narrow gain and a narrow absorption feature. And what you can do with that is, well, just do what many people do now, and then you make use of that dispersion to slow down light. Okay, so if you have a narrow feature, this is just the real part of the refractive index in that medium for the propagating light, and around this Raman resonance here, then there's a line width, 2 kilohertz, as I said, which is very narrow, and you have either anomalous dispersion on the resonance for the absorption or normal dispersion. If you look at the probe beam, which experiences some gain, okay. Now, then you calculate the group velocity, and it's just given by the Bragg line width divided by the logarithm of the absolute gain. Okay, and if you put some numbers, you see that the light is very slow in the condensate, and the way you measure that is the following, actually. In order to make way for the probe beam to the detector, you can put the pump beam from the side. That just means that the standing wave is now tilted with respect to the axis, as we have discussed so far. And you can think of the gain being originated by the pump light being reflected on this grating. Okay, so that provides the gain here. Now, oops. If you take a, you keep the pump on in the regime where you have no transient phenomenon, so that you can describe the whole thing by a refractive index, and you shine in a probe beam that is going like that in a Gaussian manner, and you measure that with and without condensation, condensate in the way, you see that the pulse gets sort of shifted and slowed down, and you see that the time delay is about 20 microseconds, and the size of the condensate is 20 micrometer, so that means that the group velocity is 1 meter per second in that case, which is reasonably slow. And you should realize, of course, there are other experiments right now that use EIT processes in the electronic structure of the atoms. Here we are using just the coherence of the matter wave itself. The coherence is really this coherence that you see as a visible density grating. Okay, that is then later on scattering the pump.
But I mean, you can still in principle locate the pulse completely inside the condensate and also create the waves longer than the pulse width?
Okay, no, we cannot create delays longer than the pulse width because our gain is small and the line is narrow. In the EIT experiment, the gain is large and the line is not that narrow. The sort of the velocities that we are talking about are comparable, but the absolute pulse delay is limited because we cannot, in terms of the pulse length, is limited because we cannot make this pulse smaller because then the spectral width is wider than our gain feature. Okay, so in that respect, the EIT people have an advantage because they have a large gain compensating basically for the huge absorption in their sample to allow for the transmission. So, I mean, I think of these EIT experiments as effectively containing two materials or two gases. One is the absorptive gas, and the other one is the one that provides gain, that compensates for the absorption. And if you think of that that way, then this gain-providing material or gas has a gain that is huge. And in our case, the gain is maybe two or something. Well, not that large, and that is the difference between the two approaches. On the other hand, here it's just actually what we are probing here are phonons or say excitations in this condensate, and we have looked into lifetimes of phonons with pump probe techniques and things like that. Okay, but the final thing that I wanted to discuss here is that you not only can have gain for the light, but you also can have gain for the matter waves that go through this effective four-wave mixing process. Now, how can we talk about gain for matter? I mean, that's certainly different than in the case of photons, because you cannot just create the atoms out of nothing, right? So it must be a situation where you have a reservoir sitting somewhere, and you have to have a process that when you send in some atoms, transfers some of the reservoir atoms into the mode of propagation of those of the atoms that you are sending in. Okay, so the mechanism that is doing this is again this light scattering mechanism on these density gratings. Okay, so we put some pump light from the side and force more atoms out of that reservoir into the mode of the ingoing atoms. And the way this works is again this one here. If you take atoms and you send it through a condensate, they have a fixed phase relation, then they produce a density grating due to the interference of the moving and the sitting condensate here. That is this standing wave as they overlap. And if you don't do anything, then they just penetrate each other and nothing happens. But if you put, that's what the picture looks like. If you do this experiment, if you just shoot off some atoms from the condensate in that direction and you wait a little while, you see them out there. Okay. Now, if you, while they are overlapping here, shine this pump light, then due to the fact that this is really a density grating, a phase grating for this light, we will redirect part of that light into that direction. And that is, of course, just phase matched and also phase locked to the input of the matter wave, because if this phase of the input atom shifts, this pattern will shift, and it will shift that phase as well. So this is a coherent gain process that provides more atoms in the output. And if you do this experiment, oops, this is how it looks like. I mean, it just shows you that in one little cartoon or in one measurement that you can produce a larger number of atoms here. Actually, this is a very low gain. Actually, what we get in the experiment is our gains, or I show you a gain line, I think here, yes, our gains of 30. That's what I'm going to describe in the next few transparencies, but we have also seen gains that are much higher. And that means that in our detection, the initial wave packet, we can't see it anymore, right? And only if we amplify, we see it. Okay, this is a gain curve, so this is in, number of atoms out. It's a linear amplifier, and the gain is about 30. But of course, the big question is whether it's really a phase coherent process, namely that what you get out here has the same phase or a fixed phase relation to what you put in. And that's you have that to study that, you have to do an interference experiment. So we set up this two-arm Ramsey interferometer to check for that, this phase coherence. Okay, so how do you build up an interferometer? You just, this is the time axis here, and you have a sitting condensate here, and you split off, again with a Bragg pulse, Bragg grating, part of that condensate and send it out of the condensate here, and you send another one out here. Then, this is a Ramsey experiment. There's some time difference here, and you can choose the phase of this grating here and move it with respect to this grating and expect a constructive and destructive interference feature as you change this phase. So this is just the principle of this interferometer, and it shows a fringe that is shown here as you change this phase of this laser beam by changing the phase of the radio frequency of an acousto-optic modulator, you see either constructive or destructive interference for certain phases here. Okay. So why do we do this? Well, let's do the next step and make this first pulse very weak. Okay. If this first pulse is very weak, then this little matter wave that comes out, although it's interfering with this one, doesn't lead to a visible interference pattern. The visibility is gone just due to the fact that the amplitude of this wave is very small. And that's what you see here. If you do it in that situation, that just means that this laser power is now small, this laser power is large, you don't see any visibility. And now, of course, in order to check whether the amplifier works, you put the amplifier right here and amplify it to the same amplitude again. So you have the weak seed pulse, you have an amplification pulse that is only one laser beam here, right? These are two laser beams that imprint in this Bragg process a standing wave, but this one has no phase relation anymore, right? It's just one laser beam that you apply for 20 microseconds, such that the outgoing matter wave has almost the same amplitude as the reference one here. And then you see some interference again. Okay, there is a pattern again with this gain of 30. It's not quite perfect, as you see, and we can discuss that. There are some reasons why the amplified matter wave does not perfectly match with the reference wave. There is some phase distortions as we go on due to the optical properties of the condensate. But it doesn't hinder that you get a visible fringe again. So that way you can really compare again the two equal arms in the interferometer to the weak and amplified interferometer. And that really shows that the gain process that we are having is a phase coherent process. So what this really is an active atom interferometer, like an active interferometer for light that is often used for precision measurements. Think of the ring laser gyroscopes, for example, for precision inertial sensing. And this is a matter wave interferometer that has this amplification in there. Okay, right, what is the difference between atom laser and The amplifier, well, let's see whether this, okay. You know this picture, of course. I just put it in because it's so nice. What you see here is, oh, it has no connection. Okay, sorry. But you know this picture where the atoms are dropping out and you are constantly coupling out atoms from a sitting condensate. This is this process. So the pulses that come out from a condensate that is just opened and closed, or where you drill a little hole and let some atoms out, these phases are sort of random. Okay. Whereas if you do what we are doing, namely you send in a wave, a matter wave into a condensate, then it's really a seeding process. It's like injection locking a laser diode that initially has sort of a drifting phase with some master light that fixes the phase to some value. And that's sort of the difference between say a free running atom laser and a injection locked or seeded amplifier that we have investigated here. Okay. So finally, what about the future? Well, let us speculate a little bit. Okay, this is just now what can be done further. I've shown you that with this standing light fields, you can do geometrical optics, you can do Bragg diffraction, you can do four wave mixing, you can manipulate the light, and you can amplify even the matter waves. But this story is not finished yet. If you put these atoms, these quantum gases, into a lattice, then first of all, it is a perfect initial state for many things. You can investigate lattices in various dimensions, of course, almost at perfect T equals zero conditions, so under pure circumstances. And of course, these atoms have internal structure, so at least the easiest thing to do first is maybe look at two-level systems in every atom, you know, assign a qubit with a hyperfine structure, say here, and look for the effects that are going on in these lattices due to the interaction of those individual atoms. We have not talked about the interaction in these lattices yet. So that is relevant for people in solid state physics, for example. They are interested in clean situation experiments to investigate quantum phase transitions there. I show you one example, maybe that's the Mott insulator transition. There's a first experiment that has proven some results in the Munich group just a few weeks ago, addressing the question of the Mott insulator transition, which is often discussed in a Bose-Hubbard type model. And what this is that you have now an interacting quantum gas with an interaction strength U that is in a lattice that has a tunnel coupling J, say. And as you are able in these lattices to vary the J and the U just by the potential depths, you can move along this axis as function of time, either adiabatically, if you like, or non-adiabatically, or even in a modulated way. So this is the chemical potential plotted here, and you see the different phases. That's from that paper here by Fisher. And one of the interesting phases might be this one, where you have exactly one atom sitting at every lattice side. Now, that's interesting for people in solid state physics, but of course it's crucial for everything that you are discussing now in quantum information also, because it really makes these indistinguishable atoms that you have in a condensate at T equals zero distinguishable again. And that's that's decisive in order if you want to address them later on and assign a qubit with a certain lattice. If you don't, I mean, you first, before you do any quantum computation or any processing there, you first have to be there, otherwise you cannot address single qubits. Yeah. Okay, so that's why this is a very interesting and important development right now. And I think that as it looks like one can do this, this will be the basis for further studies in that field. Then there are, let's see. Okay, now just to illustrate what the interaction does in another picture. Well, you can discuss it in these lattices, but you can also maybe discuss it just in a double wall potential, which is maybe the easier way to look at that, because you don't have to deal with the Bloch states and so on. If you have, say, a splitter, 50-50 beam splitter, say in this integrated optic device or in whatever situation, and you come in with a state that is a macroscopically populated single particle wave function, and you have no interaction in the splitter, then you split the effective single wave particle, a single particle wave function, and you still occupy it macroscopically, so nothing really dramatic has been going on. But if you introduce now some interaction, repulsive or attractive interaction between those particles, and that naturally occurs, then the energetically favorable ground state that you will build here in this double well potential is either for the repulsive interaction, that the one state is filled with half of the particle and the other state is filled with exactly half of the particle, or in the attractive interaction, you're building a generalized GHZ state. Namely, it's energetically favorable to put all the atoms in the attractive interaction case in channel, well, in state 3, or all the atoms in channel 4, okay? So the interaction coming into play there will produce non-classical states, and that is, of course, beyond, and that's then quantum optics, I would say. Yeah, that's where quantum optics comes in. The interactions itself are also a subject of research right now. There's the possibility to tune the interaction strength, even from attractive to repulsive interaction. That's work done in the Dula group, where you see that the scattering length, which is the scalar parameter that the scalar parameter that characterizes the strength of the attraction or the repulsion, can be tuned, and it can be tuned from negative to positive values just by changing magnetic fields. This is very much dependent on which atom you're actually using. Yeah, this is rubidium-85, and it looks different in other atoms. So in a way, as you are able to tune the atom-light interaction by tuning the light field, you know, for example, the tuning of the light field, you have another parameter here, namely the magnetic field, to tune the interaction strength of the atoms within each, among each other. You can even make it to zero if you like, of course. So this interaction is a contact interaction. So it, in a lattice, say, it can only be on-site interaction and has no longer range. What I find very promising, and that's what we are concentrating on a little bit, is long-range interactions, because you really don't want to get qubits interacting by moving them physically. You know, this interaction was a contact interaction, you would have to move this qubit to this qubit and let them interact here and move them apart. That sort of is experimentally hard, I would say, and it would be much more elegant to have a long-range interaction. And the interaction in question is the dipole-dipole interaction. Now, the dipole-dipole interaction is a vectorial one, so it has if you have two dipoles, it's either repulsive or attractive, depending on the orientation. So it's isotropic. And, okay, it can be neglected in all alkali systems in terms of the magnetic dipole-dipole interaction. It's not the case in chromium. That's one of the atoms that we are working with. There you have a large magnetic moment and therefore a larger magnetic dipole-dipole interaction, and we are currently studying these atoms and try to get a condensate and study the effects of the dipole-dipole interaction in the condensate and later on also in the lattice. Now, the dipole-dipole interaction can also be introduced into the game temporarily by exciting maybe alkali atoms to Rydberg states and provide an electric field which induces very strong electric dipoles for a short time, and that can also be used to link to neighboring dipoles. There's a proposal by Zoller how to implement a fast quantum gate without moving physically the atoms by the long-range nature of these of this interaction. And of course, if you have heteronuclear molecules from the very start, I mean, they have a very strong electric dipole moment, and that will dominate the physics. And the contact interaction that we are dealing with so far is of no importance whatsoever anymore. Okay, so I personally believe that there will be a lot of future in these long-range interactions, and we are working in our new lab now on this chromium and also on the Rydberg states and on the molecules, but it's all in a very early stage. So, well, things in solid-state physics involve supersolids, and if you have long-range interaction, you can think of building supersolids. Okay, I guess my time is over. I just conclude with what I was telling you about light waves interacting with matter waves, simple application of that idea for lithography. I presented first some nanostructures that we have been creating. Structure doping was one of the things that you can do with that. Integrated atom optics, still with thermal atoms, but cold atoms very close to the surface, as a possibility to manipulate the atoms on the sites that you really want to address. Then I discussed a little, very briefly, just the optical properties of condensates in this Raman-type situation where you have a back diffraction going on, and finally discussed matter wave amplification and active atom interferometers. Now, I should mention that the lithography work is done, work done in Konstanz, my former place before I actually went to MIT, and this is my group there. They have all finished their thesis now. It is now being taken over by a guy called Markus Oberthaler. The cold chromium atoms, which you actually see here as a picture, is now an experiment that we have moved to my new place in Stuttgart, and these people came with me. Dominik Schneble is actually now a postdoc with Wolfgang Ketterle, and he did in my group these experiments on the integrated atom optics. It was a pleasure for me to stay on with Wolfgang for some time and participate in these experiments. And I would particularly like to mention Shin Inui, at that time a PhD student in Wolfgang's group, which I collaborated a lot with. And finally, we are now in this new place, Stuttgart. You know that maybe you know that the Porsche is fabricated there. Yes, not only Mercedes-Benz, but also the fastest cars. So it lets us hope that there will be even more performance. And we have some senior people, Axel Görlitz, who was a postdoc until recently with Wolfgang Ketterle, who has now joined our group, Yuri Ovchinnikov, who was previously working with Bill Phillips at NIST, a bunch of PhD students and diploma students that have joined the group now, and that was it. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. Of course, the question.
Oh, sorry, there's some music in.
So I have a question with this magnetic dipole interactions of chromium. I think that should be weaker than the dipole interaction that you can create among sort of ground state atoms if you just apply laser fields. Isn't that correct?
Oh, yes. Of course, you're talking about the resonantly excited electric dipoles in laser fields.
Off resonance.
Well, that's also, it depends on the detuning, that's also true. If you excite them with laser light, then you're always subject to, of course, also spontaneous emission processes. And if you go to a regime where you want to have considerable dipole-dipole interaction, then the spontaneous emission kills you, basically, because the interaction strength in a typical configuration, say in frequency terms, it's in a kilohertz regime, so, or even below that. So you would have to wait many, many milliseconds until you see any effect of that dipole-dipole interaction. So it will be hard, at least, just with the dipole-dipole interaction due to electronic excitation. However, the situation changes in the optical lattice again. If you are in the Lamp-Dicke regime, you are suppressing some of the inelastic scattering, and that's exactly one of the things that one also might consider. Mm-hmm.
The question about your long-range interaction, it's helpful if it's long-range, but it can also be bad because it's interactors. Many other atoms.
Yes, yes, sure, yeah.
So you would like to have a long-range searchable interaction.
Yes, I mean, of course, ideally on a lattice you would really like to link this one only to this one and nobody else, yes. So...
What we're reading is the dangers of the long range,
okay. It depends on what you want to do, of course. If you, for example, want to link two qubits, then the proposal by Zoller says you excite the dipoles by exciting them into Rydberg states only for those two sides by just using the frequency selectivity that is very, very high. Rydberg atoms are extremely sensitive to external electric fields, and if you have an electric field gradient, it is enough shift from one side to the next one to address every single qubit in this lattice just by the frequency you choose for your excitation laser. So that way you can have everybody in the ground state and only two in the dipole case, and then only they are interacting. Well, that's certainly possible. If you have magnetic or permanent dipoles that you cannot really switch, then you have to go into situations where you flip those dipoles again in a selective way. Okay, so say you have them all lined up in a certain direction, say this way, okay, and then you start to flip one of them, okay, and you want to, for example, flip this one that way and that one that way, and then you have a repulsive interaction, but with those ones, there's no interaction, okay? So there are schemes how to flip the dipoles accordingly that you can only select the ones that you are interested in. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
yes, we can. All right.